time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 668 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is the return of Gene Ha, an accomplished artist, writer, storyteller who continues doing an excellent job with both the writing and the art on May, the definitive edition coming from Oni Press. Gene talks about the upcoming collected edition, which you can pre-order now through your local comic shop and also on Amazon.com. It'll be released in April of 2025. Here's the book's description. May, the definitive edition, includes all 12 issues of Gene Ha's masterpiece comic series, remastered and fully realized to the creator's ultimate vision, with never-before-seen story pages, new story edits, and a cavalcade of behind-the-scenes extra features, all collected in this stunning volume. We talk about how this comic came to be, who the various characters are, and what else Gene will be up to in the months ahead. He also discusses having two other writers, Mark Waid and Molly Jean Kremer, contributing tales to the series. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what Gene has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Gene Ha is the artist on Wonder Woman Historia, The Amazons, Volume 2, with writer Kelly Sue DeConnick from DC Comics. That graphic novel has won the Best Graphic Album Reprint of the 2024 Eisner Awards. So with that, he has four other Eisner Awards for his art, including Alan Moore's Top 10, which I always loved, and various Marvel and DC superhero comics. Gene also writes and draws May from Oni Press, which we have discussed previously. The story of May Fortell, a girl who follows her long-missing sister Abby to a world of mad science and mystery. And we're going to be talking about that because there's a big development as far as May goes. So how you doing, Gene?
I'm doing okay. So, I feel like every year since the middle of the last decade, I say it's been a crazy year, but it continues to be true. I keep on waiting for life to get boring again, and it just won't happen.
Well, that's not a bad thing, I suppose.
Good and bad.
So let's why don't you tell people what's going on with me? Because there's a big development people should know about.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So if you were going to try to buy a new copy of May Volume 1 or Volume 2, you'll find out that it's sold out worldwide at the wholesale level. So you'll have to buy a used copy and probably even like a used library copy. But it is being reissued next year. It's up for pre-order now from your local comic shop, from your local bookstore, or Amazon if you don't have those nearby you. And it's all collected together. It's got a lot of new material. It'll have 12 new pages of story, various bonus features, even some support for teachers and librarians who want to use it for reading clubs or a class assignment. So I'm very, very excited to have this coming out. And it's all in one big volume instead of two volumes.
Yeah, it's called May the Definitive Edition. And it's going to be kind of out in the spring. So there's plenty of time to get the order in and make sure your store knows about it so that you can get it and stuff like that. So, do you want to describe it or shall I read what Amazon says about it?
Let's start off with the Amazon description.
All right. May's beloved older sister, Abby, has been missing for years. May has her theories about where Abby might be, but never in her wildest dreams do those theories encompass a fantasy world full of terrifying monsters, power-hungry nobles, and nefarious scientists. That is, until Abby suddenly returns. She convinces May to return with her to the fantastical realm, and I never can pronounce this right. Cimmerturin? Is that how you pronounce it?
It's based on Czech, and so it's hard for me, even me, to get the pronunciation right, because I do not speak Czech. But as close as I can get, there's a T before the C, a pronounced T before the C, so it's Cimmerturin.
Okay. All right. We'll take that as the legitimate one. To join in her quest to find their missing father. He's disappeared without a trace. Abby believes it to be the work of the malicious nobility. The sisters must fight their way to the heart of the land to find their father. That's what it was described. Now, I happened to jump on board with this back when it was coming out individually from Oni Press. And so I just love it. I always tell people, if you want to read a book that was way ahead of its time when it comes to strong female characters, this is like the primo book about that. Because, man, this was one of the very first really strong female characters I ever read. And it is just superbly done, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I should emphasize, it's not just like there's a long history of action hero female characters in comics. But I wanted to do, at the time in pop culture especially, there weren't female lead character heroes who were geeks and who were things like scientists or comic geeks or all these things rolled up, which is what the main character May, spelled M-A-E, is. And generally, until very, very recently, if you were the female geek inside of an action-adventure story, you were the person on the other side in a control booth looking at a computer telling the male hero, okay, you need to go down the hall 20 paces, go through that door, and then cut the red wire. And that was your job.
Right.
Or if you were in a romance story, if you're the female geek, you were either the best friend of the pretty girl, or if you were the romantic lead, then a boy would take your glasses off and say, oh my God, you're really pretty once you take your glasses off. And the girl would say something equivalent to, oh, thank God I don't have to be a geek anymore. That sucked. Now I can be a real girl. And I wanted to get away from that.
Because, you know, I always think of Buffy when I think of that. Her friend was the geek.
Yeah.
What was her name? I can't remember her name, but she was...
Willow?
Willow, that's it. Willow was... She was the geek. And she was always there. Her job was to... When Buffy was sent to go, what? She would explain what was going on. And I was always like, But it was nice to see actually a geek-ess as a lead character, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm looking at this as a male geek. I mean, if you're going into a world where there are supernatural creatures coming after you, or evil wizards, or mad scientists, I mean, who better to be able to take on these challenges and know how the history of what banes will drive away a werewolf or a vampire than a geek who's been reading about this stuff because he's been a dungeon master or a science fiction geek or just weirdly into history, or she, which is the point of May. They will know this stuff. And if they're a smarter geek than me, they might even know how to do science and build radios and do other neat things with technology. So, Willow in that sense should have been the hero of the story.
Yeah. I always wondered why, of course, Buffy was the one who could punch and kick much better than Willow. Yeah. So that was why that was. But how long have you been working on this story? Because you and I talked several years ago when you had just finished up volume 2. So how long has May been going on for you?
It's been an on passion project since about 2015. I began making doodles of it probably around 2013, but it was not, the story hadn't really come together then. I just had these two characters very much based on a Kyle Baker story, Why I Hate Saturn. But one of the sisters is delusional, but I thought the delusional sister had this fantasy world that was so interesting. It was like, oh, that would make a really great fantasy story if it was true. But it was a fantasy about living in space and being the queen of the leather satin girls. And I began doodling my little fan fiction version of these characters because I love that story so much. And at some point, it went from being a space story to me putting a kind of a Revolutionary War, Napoleonic era long coat on one of the sisters. And I realized, oh, this isn't set in space anymore, is it? Where do these girls go for their adventures now? And that's how Mate came about. I began building the world where those characters, where the costumes made sense. Very much in the same sense that, like, Tolkien, when he invented Elvish, wasn't planning on writing a high fantasy or inventing high fantasy. He was just playing around with, like, making a language he liked. And then he thought to himself, now that I've put all this work into inventing Elvish, what kind of world would this language come from? And that's how he built the Lord of the Rings, the Silmarillion, the Hobbit, and then the Lord of the Rings.
And that wild stuff, because it's amazing to me where great stories come from, because, you know, like, for example, the Harry Potter books, you know, all came because the I always forget her name, the lady who wrote those Harry Potter books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she, Rowling.
Yeah, Rowling, J.K. Rowling. She had a child, and she wanted to write. She had, I guess her husband had divorced her, and she was kind of on her own in the UK. And she would take this child to a restaurant, and the restaurant employees would entertain the child while she wrote. And I remember she was so poor, when they said she had, at Scholastic, she had to turn in two copies. She had to sit and retype the copy. She couldn't afford to get it Xeroxed.
Wow.
And so now, of course, look.
Yeah. I'll say also a lot of great stories came about, like Tolkien. He had this whole history of the elves. It wasn't really a story anyone would especially want to read yet. It was a lot of notes and ideas. But it became a real story when he needed to tell bedtime stories to his kids. And he took an essay project or a class project of write a story based on this beginning, and then use that to build a children's story for his kids that he suddenly realized after a few nights, oh, this is set inside the world where I built for my Elvish language project. And it kind of expanded from there.
I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who wrote the who wrote a lot of literature, and it was during World War II, and he had like a large home outside of London. And what the people did was they sent a lot of people with families, sent their children up there to stay with him. Darn, his name just escapes him right now. I'm not remembering things too well right now. But he, the kids were there, and they were constantly going and saying to him, what are we going to do now? And so he started telling stories to entertain these children.
Is that C.S.? I don't know the history.
C.S. Lewis, that's it.
C.S. Lewis.
Okay. C.S. Lewis, that's it. That's who did it. And that eventually became, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia, and I don't know, I remember who it is. I remember all the stuff. But all that stuff came around because of, here were these children that he had to entertain, and he started telling them stories that were somewhat biblically based, and then he did these things, and little did he know, he had a whole new genre of storytelling that happened as a result of all that. So I'm always fascinated. I like to know where things come from, because it's so amazing to me how people develop stories and where they come from. And it just amazes me, because I was going to ask too about where did the characters come from, but now I know, because you've said based on, you read those stories, and based on those other characters, you developed your characters as a result of them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, an important note is it started off with the action hero sister, Abby/Annie, as the main character. And at a certain point, I realized she's not somebody who's going to grow. She's somebody who goes in and punches things when she gets angry. But I felt like the other sister, who was kind of the Willow to the Buffy, was a much more interesting character. And she would go into these, if when I began inventing situations for them, she had a much more interesting reaction to everything. And she also had a lot more growth to do, because she was willing to see her own mistakes and change up because of them. And in the classic action story, there's a game writer who I really love. This sounds like an aside, but it's really relevant. There's a game writer called Robin Laws who said that Hollywood, of course, is obsessed with the dramatic character who starts off in one point, goes through an adventure, changes, and becomes somebody new by the end of the story. It's this coming of age, every story is kind of a coming of age story in Hollywood.
Right.
But if you look at the classic stories of serial characters like Sherlock Holmes or Batman or James Bond, they don't fix the world by becoming better people. they fix the world by staying true to themselves and not changing. Any changes are superficial. After the origin story of Batman, Batman remains the same person. And by being true to that mission of vengeance for evil, you know, saving the, you know, saving good people and never quitting the fight, that's how he makes the world better. And that's it's an iconic character. By staying true to his iconic self, he changed the world. That's what Abby's like. She's not a dramatic character, especially.
Isn't that fascinating?
She's a bit like Batman or a bit like James Bond, that by shooting or beating up or kicking the butt of bad people, she thinks she can fix the world, which I just can't really write a world like that. It just doesn't feel true to me at all emotionally. Mm-hmm. And then I liked, so that's why I threw in, made May the main character, because she can look at these situations and say, what are we really trying to do? It's like the whole question of like, you know, if Bruce Wayne wants to fix Gotham City, how is he going to do it? By punching people over and over again, because there's too many bad people to punch, and they're not going to learn the lesson of they need to stop being bad by being hit. And there's a lot of other ways to do it, and clever writers can create reasons why his charitable efforts fail, but it's not fixing the problem. Batman never fixes the problem.
Of course, in Batman comics, Batman can't fix the problem because there needs to be another Batman comic next month.
Yeah. And also people are coming there to read about Batman hitting another bad guy. So there's always going to be a new problem for him to punch. But I didn't want to write that story. Mm-hmm. It's been told endlessly. And I felt like I could do something new with May, or at least different from that, if I did a story of somebody a little more curious, a little more willing to look at anew at the situations, mm-hmm. by throwing an intellectually curious geek into an action hero world and realizing you people are not fixing the problems.
Wow. Okay. So basically you know how this May story ends, apparently.
Oh yeah. And this is not a story about pacifists, and it's not a story saying pacifism and, you know, kumbaya is the only way to solve all the problems of the world and everything will be fine. But it is saying that you do have to figure out the root causes of problems. You have to figure out who the person actually, what things are actually causing the problems before you can fix them. And inside of a dramatic superhero story, it tends to be there's a villain who hates the hero and will do anything to annoy the hero. And if you punch the villain enough, the problem will go away. I like to think of this as, oh my God, a plague is destroying the land. I need to find the villain, the plague villain, and punch him in the face. And then everyone will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. That's how you solve problems. That's what comic book people do anyway, is with those kind of things. But what's nice, that's one of the things I enjoy about May, is that it is a very different kind of storytelling than I'm used to in comics. And again, with the female leads, which I still find there's not nearly enough of them in my comic reading. So, but and also you're right, the problem solving is a great change in there. And so that was one of the things I enjoyed about May, is being able to read people who could actually solve problems.
Yeah. Though, I mean, I will mention, of course, when you're talking about like writers doing strong female characters, of course, I've worked with writers like Kelly Sue DeConnick, and you mentioned at the start of the show, Historia, and the way she's able to take these female characters and put them to action and have them clash over goals, but still work together and still be a sisterhood, because it's the mascara. It's just, I am so in awe of her creativity that she's done so many books with so many great male and female characters. It's all, you know, I'm a little humbled to be able to, that I got the chance to work with her. And when it was actually her husband, I hadn't met her yet. Her husband, Matt Fraction, that said, you know who, my wife would like to work with you. Would you be interested? And I said, yes. And he said, well, you want to know more about the project? And I said, yes, I want to know more about this project. But I'm going to start off by saying, I'm on board. Now tell me about the project.
Ah, that's funny, because it reminds me one time when I was selling a comic book. My roommate was the one that created the comic, and we were at cons selling them at tables and stuff like that. And so we had the speech we would make. And so I said the first line of the speech, and the person raised his hand and said, "Stop." He says, "I'm going to buy the book. Don't tell me anymore." And I said, "Okay." Sold him on the first line. So, the wise storytellers can do those kinds of things, I think, and make it, because like with Manson, now you got my attention when you said there's a new story in the upcoming book.
There's a set of let me see, I think 12 pages total of new story by me, two extra pages by somebody else, actually. I shouldn't but yeah, it's, I go through a few things where I explain some things, like some technology I didn't have before. But the biggest, most important story, it's 4 pages long. It's near the end of the book, but it gives the origin of why. Okay, so you gave the description of the plot description of May from Amazon, in which the older sister, Abby, I'm going to go with a little more detail, 8 years before the story starts, at the age of 13, disappears. And she disappears because she found a doorway to another world, Simmertown. And she went a few times and then just decided to stop coming back. And that 4-page story near the end of the expanded story explains why she didn't come back.
Wow.
And part of it is just like, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but it's not a huge spoiler. If you've read the story before, or if you just want to know, the two sisters live in Northwest Indiana in a rural county. And Abby is a lesbian. She's 13 years old, but she knows she doesn't fit in. She's not a girly girl. She's attracted to other girls. And her life is kind of becoming hell because she's also just socially awkward. She's not the same kind of geek as May is, but she just can't quite fit in with the rest of the kids in school. And I kind of give the story of how she just said, "Okay, I've had enough of this crap. I'm staying in this other world."
Interesting, because I was definitely considering buying the book, but now you really sold me, because new May stories are, boy, I'm looking forward to that. I got to make sure I get that ordered so I get that and I can read those stories, because I want to, those kinds of things. This book always was, the word I always like to use is enchanting. It engaged me on different levels, and you're right about the storytelling and other things like that. It was different from other comics that I like to read, and I love variety in my reading, by the way. And so this is one of those books that scratched that variety itch for me really well, because it was different, because the characters were different. And I was always wanting to see what they were going to do next. And so for me, I hate to say it because the hardcover is coming out, but do you have other May stories in mind that you might get back to?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have volume 3 plotted out. I know where each of the characters ends up. They'll say part of my writing process is when I throw characters into a situation, they often find different ways to react and different solutions or problems than the ones I expect them to find. They will get angry at different times than I expected, or be cleverer in different ways than I expected. It's one of those weird things of like, you don't have to be a quick-witted super genius to write a super genius. But what takes them 5 seconds to solve can take you weeks or months to solve. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have to kind of set it up. But yeah, the characters are always surprising me when I write. And I've met writers who say they know the whole plot and are never surprised by their stories when they write, say, for a comic book or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to name names, but I don't find the work by these writers all that interesting. Because so often, if you're not surprising yourself as a writer, it often turns out you're not surprising the reader either.
Isn't that fascinating? Because, you know, this is why I'm not a writer. I can tell you what's a great story, and I can, but I tend to write, and I've tried to write stories. They really end up being sort of, namby-pamby kind of story. No surprise along the way and stuff. I like to be surprised, but I have a hard time coming up with surprises. So this is why I admire your stuff, because there were several big surprises in May's story that I really enjoyed. And I can only admire that kind of and respect that kind of writing, because it's just not natural for me to do that.
Well, I've got, okay, so I should talk this over someday with a writer like Kelly Sue DeConnick or something, but I have a theory about plot twists and how I do them and why I think they don't work for, like, especially on TV shows or some genre, like movies and stuff like that, especially plot twists don't work. And I think a lot of writers think that a plot twist is a surprise turn in the story of, like, say, the character who was good all along, you're going to reveal, oh, but they've always been a villain. But you don't, it's not really set up or anything like that. It's just, twist, this person's a villain now. Oh, now this person's a villain. Now it turns out, a vampire suddenly drops into the story. Plot twist. And the trick that I found that works for stories I read and I try to do when I write for plot twists as such is that you want to tell a really good story that the reader, you know, what the reader recognizes as a story they're enjoying, where the story makes sense and it's going in a certain direction. But at the same time, you're telling another story and it's exactly the same story. But when the reveal comes, when the twist comes, it's just that there have been other things happening at the same time. And there's another story I've been telling the whole time, but I wasn't doing it really obviously. And that's the twist. You just reveal what the extra story is. It's not suddenly, you know, the good guy's a bad guy and the bad guy's a good guy and just doing that over and over and over again. Or, you know, this person's a murderer. It's actually setting up another, you know, having that story kind of built in as you're going along. But, and then the other thing is surprising yourself, which is I've read of a few cases, I can't name the names, but mystery writers who, when they're writing a murder mystery, don't know who the murderer is. And in that sense, it's the answer is usually a surprise, because they're not setting up who the murderer is. They're setting up all the clues, but even the murder mystery writer in that case has to go through the clues and solve the mystery to figure out who's doing it, who's done what.
Because I've always, when I've talked to mystery writers, they always, you say, have to know the solution before you can write the whole story. But what I like, and I don't like something that appears out of the blue. I like where there are clues or hints along the way, and suddenly something happens and you go, oh, that explains why that happened. That's my favorite kind of storytelling. When out of the blue, it's not, you know, it's not somebody is was a vampire all along and we had no idea. I don't like those kinds of stories. I like the ones where we kind of, you know, they're interested in blood for some crazy reason, but we don't know why. And all of a sudden we come to this place and then it's revealed this person is a vampire. And that makes sense and it explains everything that happened before. That I like. That I like.
Yeah. And also because we've been so inundated with vampires for the last 20 years. I mean, a good way to do it also is just you can tell a story about somebody who has this suddenly can't handle sunlight anymore and wants to drink blood. And then if you actually give a logical explanation that's not vampires, but you've been setting up along that there's a logical reason why this is happening that doesn't involve vampirism, it'll be a really interesting story. That's a good plot twist in the sense that you've been telling a good story that looks like a really good vampire story along. And then you add that the twist is, but here's the other story, and it's not making the character's life any simpler, and it's not pulling the rug and saying, canceling or erasing all the stuff that happened before.
Yeah.
All that stuff went to build the bigger story that you're doing.
Yeah, see, that to me is great writing. I love it when somebody – I'm sitting going – I'll give you an example and on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We were watching and there was the doctor was there and he kept talking about all these engineering classes he took when he was studying to be a doctor. And we were always going, why would a doctor take engineering classes? You know, how could he even have time to take engineering classes? And the fifth season of the show, suddenly it was revealed that he had been genetically enhanced. And so not only could he do you know, medical stuff, but he could do engineering stuff as well because he was this enhanced person. And I thought, oh, I said, that explains all this stuff that happened way back in season one. Because, you know, my friends and I, we love to talk about that show and dissect it. And when they showed that in there, we all just looked at each other. Oh, my goodness. They've just explained all this stuff from seasons ago. And I love that.
I'll say it's a real life thing. I come from a family of polymaths, people who are naturally talented and quick to learn new skills, including especially intellectual skills. And I'm not one of them. I am not a polymath. Oh,
okay.
But my dad was the kind of person where, like, he wasn't always book smart, but he studied really hard, but he was also incredibly creative. He was an anesthesiologist. And he was famous for, if there was a problem with an operation or something like that, he was able to re-engineer the anesthesiology equipment in the middle of an operation so it would work differently. He was just able to MacGyver things just out of scraps of rubber tubing and clamps, and just, he loved inventing, and he was kind of a natural born engineer.
Wow. Wow. Well, I guess maybe, I don't know if they knew anything about that when they were doing this, but
yeah. My mom was able to learn to sight read piano in 5 months at the age of about 68.
Wow.
And she'd never really played piano before, but just decided to stay at home, take a few lessons, and then bought herself a baby grand piano and learned within five months to credibly sight read reasonably difficult songs on that piano. And like she always does, because she's a polymath and this is easy for her. And then she quit, and the piano's still there, but she never plays it anymore.
Why?
Because it's easy for her, unlike me. She just picks up skills, and my two brothers were both like this, where they just picked up skills, and classes were easy for them, and they could get B's and A minuses without studying. So why bother? Why stress out?
Wow. Oh, boy. I can only respect people like that. That's amazing stuff.
Yeah. And I was not a polymath, so I just liked drawing a lot, but I had to really focus on it.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. It's so interesting. Even within your own family, there's variations within the people and stuff. Really, really fun.
Improvisation and writing. So there's two things I read that really influenced me on this. The first is On Writing. I think it's called On Writing by Stephen King, where he talked about how he tries not to plot ahead and to always surprise himself when he's writing. Though he did go through a bad period where he was had been hit by a car and then was addicted to pain medications for a few years, and his plots went a little crazy. But in general, he says, don't overplot a book beforehand if you can help it. And then this got repeated later to me, or told me later in different words from a different writer, really respect, Alan Moore, when I was working with him, where on the first issue, he said he was setting little plot elements for himself that he was going to play with later, but he didn't know what he was going to do with them for sure. And he explained, like, I'm going to have this piece of music that's going to be the solution to a mystery later. I'm not sure exactly how it'll work out. I'm going to have the handprint on one of the in top 10 characters' chest, Jeff Smacks. I have a history of how that happened, but I don't know how that story's going to come out. And he just did all these elements where he wasn't going to plot out ahead how it was all going to work out. But he knew that he was creative today, and he was going to be just as creative tomorrow and 8 months from now and a year from now. And he would come up with more interesting new solutions. And the way I like to think of it is that you have to trust that if you are creative, it's a constant flow. And if you try to plot everything out when you start a project and make all the creative decisions right away in, let's say, 1 month or something like that, you're not giving yourself all the room you need, say, 6 months later in the project to keep on adding more stuff to it where you might come up with better answers. And just trust that if you're creative today, you will be creative tomorrow, and it will be a constant output, and use all of it. and leave yourself room to use all of it.
Because I've listened to writers talk about that, because they have like a writing room. People will write it around. And there are certain writers in television, I could name names, but I won't, who believe that gold drips from their pens. And they just basically tell their story, and that's all there is to it. But then there's others who, when... Because we had a little writer group that wrote these like fan film things. We wrote little Star Trek stories. And we would sit there and talk about stories and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, I would come up with great ideas. And a lot of times I didn't. And I would just sit and listen to other people come up with stuff. But sometimes I would say something that would spark something in somebody else. And so the group of us were smarter than one person, because we were able to come up with stuff. And this one person gave me a script to read that this two people had written, and I read it. And the first thing that leaped out at me was there was a plot thread that they hadn't resolved. And I said to them, I said, look, I said, I can, there's this plot thread you haven't resolved. I can tell you how to resolve it in one line of dialogue. And he went back, and the one person involved said, oh no, you didn't let them read it. They're nitpickers. and my friend goes, we want nitpickers. We want them to find stuff. And sure enough, I had found this one thing that they had not remembered to resolve. And I even told them how to fix it and stuff. So it's the creative process just fascinates me so much. It's just such an amazing thing.
On May, I had two guest writers. One was Mark Wade, mm-hmm. who, you know, I mentioned at the beginning earlier inside this interview that one of the things I was trying to avoid in the story was the whole trope of the geek girl who meets the jock boy who takes off her glasses and says, oh my God, you're beautiful. You don't have to be a geek anymore. So I was never going to write that story. Mm-hmm. And that's literally the story that Mark Wade wrote, where a really gorgeous guy goes up to May, takes her glasses off and says, oh my God, you're gorgeous. And May is very heterosexual, and I drew him very, very cute. So she was a bit flummoxed, and he was willing to explore that. It's like, oh God, I didn't think that story could be written, but he wrote the story I didn't think was possible. And it was amazing. And then the other guest writer was Molly Jane Kramer, who's a comics retailer and journalist. And I visually based May's best friend on her, because she's a close friend of mine, and she's one of the geek girls who inspired me to write a story about a geek girl. And when I decided to do a focus issue on that character, I mentioned that the character is a freshman student at Purdue University, Indiana. And she's having trouble with annoying, trollish guys in the geek world. And then Molly Jane said, oh, you know, I went to Purdue. And I had problems with joining comics club, blah, blah, blah. And the guys just being assholes sometimes. And as she began telling me these stories, I just stopped her and said, okay, I'm just transcribing what you're saying. Can you please write the story for me? And she just wrote the script. It was sloppy. It was not in comics format. But then I translated into comics format, a script format, and then drew it. And she just worked back and forth with me. I was her amanuensis and wrote down what she said, put it into proper formatting. She approved it. And that was how that script got written. And I could not have done it myself, because she had lived so many of these experiences and had so many friends who'd been through these experiences. She was able to write it with an authenticity I could never do.
And that's just amazing. Now, of course, now you're both writing and doing artwork and stuff like that, but it sounds like you're doing more art these days. Do you kind of miss doing the writing, or what's going on with you as far as that balance?
I do love writing, but, the experience writing has given me more tools when I draw somebody else's story. So right now the project I'm working on is I'm doing a spinoff book from Patton Oswalt's Minor Threats. We're taking the character from the spinoff series, The Alternates, and the character is called Crab Louie, and he's got his own special issue. Gail Simone is writing it, and I'm able to see in the script what Gail is doing, and then just bring the character reactions to it, the body language, the character designs, but also emphasizing the themes and the emotions and stuff like that, using visual storytelling. Like, there's a scene, small spoiler, but not a huge one, where Crab Louie, who is essentially the swamp thing of crustaceans and crabs and lobsters, he looks like a giant heap of seafood, all hard-shelled seafood all piled together into humanoid form, who's married to a human woman, a scientist. And they're having an argument about... They're having a tense discussion about household finances at the kitchen table because she has a job, but Crab Louie is a superhero who doesn't get paid to do it. And she says, okay, I can't keep this whole household going on my own. You need to get a job. And trying to figure out the visuals of how we're going to make this not just two people sitting at a dining table staring at each other. And one of the fun tricks I had was just I put a salt and pepper shaker in the middle of the dining table they're sitting at. And one is a sailor and one is a little mermaid. And they get knocked off the table in the middle of the discussion. And then also to not turn the wife into just a total money-obsessed bitch, I also added as visuals inside the sequence a laptop showing their bank balance, which is not big anymore. It's getting closer and closer to zero. And then a bill, which I'm going to put on a number, which is not that far away from the bank balance. And to show that, no, she's not just worried about buying a fancier car. She's worried about keeping the lights on in this house.
Wow.
And that was not in the script, but it's stuff I know that Gail appreciates when I put that type of stuff in to kind of round out the characters.
Wow, isn't that something? So actually, your writing experience is making you a better artist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and when I worked on Top 10, this is late 90s, early 2000s, with Xander Cannon. Xander Cannon, at that point, had written lots and lots of stories. Replacement God, he's gone on to write many other great stories. And he was able to interpret the Alan Moore scripts in ways I wasn't able to do, even though I'd had slightly more experience in comics than he did, but it was all drawing experience, pretty much. And because he had writing experience, drawing experience, lettering experience, dealing with the printer experience, he was able to come at the script from multiple directions and pull out things that I didn't see, which is one of the reasons why he is the greatest layout artist I've ever met.
Wow.
And he's also a great writer.
Wow. Because there's some people who are wonderful artists, but... Oh, gosh, I hate to say this, but because he's not with us anymore. But Neil Adams, I thought, was one of the best artists ever. But when he got to writing, it wasn't quite as on the same level as his artwork, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But you know, he was a legend as an artist. You know, you can't take that away. But as far as when the writing came, not so much to me anyway.
Yeah. The older I get, the more I love the art of Jack Kirby. And in fact, when I was in high school, I was not a huge fan of his work. But I love every phase of Jack Kirby's career now. But I am not a big fan of his writing style, where everyone is kind of very stiff and saying punchy lines all the time. But they don't have a sense of humor anymore.
Right.
And while Stan Lee definitely stole a lot of the credit from his artists during the early Marvel days, it was definitely Stan Lee who added that great dialogue and the sense of humor and sardonicness that just really made those comics sing as stories, not just as clever ideas and brilliant visuals and great visual storytelling. He's the one who gave the soul to those early stories and made them emotionally powerful.
Well, I noticed when I read his stuff, I think he did Captain Victory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that stuff is visually, it's just...
There's the amazing trick. I loved the artwork, but the story just felt kind of standard stuff to me, which I was kind of I was disappointed because, you know, Kirby to me was one of the all-time greats. And, you know, I hated to say that, you know, that he had written a story that I didn't care for because I admired him so much. But it was his artwork will always be some of the very best artwork that's ever been in comics and probably ever will be, in my opinion, because he's just fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, God. I can't remember the name of the story, but there's an uninked pencil story Jack Kirby did in his later career about his childhood growing up in the slums of Manhattan, in this neighborhood where all the boys in the neighborhood just got into constant battles, not just kind of fights I got into as a kid, but actual battles where all the kids from one block would fight all the kids from another block. Hmm. And it is an amazing story because it actually had this kind of, because the characters were so well-rounded and so they weren't just trying to be cool and iconic and heroic or elementally evil. It's a really, really beautifully, amazingly told unfinished story.
That's amazing. That's something. So, well, let's, again, it's May, the definitive, let me make sure I get the right, the definitive edition. And you want to make sure to let your local shop know about that. And if you can't get it through there, then Amazon or Simon & Schuster or other places like that, you can get to it. It's just a fantastic book. I just highly recommend it. It's, anybody asked me, what good books about women characters? And this is one of the first ones I mentioned. I said, man, this you got to read this book. It's just spectacular.
Get it at your comic shop. Get it at your local bookstore. You can also order it that way. But also, this is important. Every author I know, including me, loves it if you get it from your local library. And my wife is a former librarian, and they love it when the patrons come in and say, you don't have this book on the shelf. Can you order it for me so I can read it? Because when they're buying books, they're just trying to guess what people want.
Right.
And if you actually come in and tell them, that makes their life simpler.
Oh, wow. And it makes the library better.
Oh, yeah.
As far as that goes, that's great. Now, as far as Chris being artist and writer, artist, both of those, what projects are coming from you that we should know about and that you can tell us about?
Oh, well, there's Crab Louie. Let me see. May is coming out again with that. But then there is a big commitment I've made to like 5 issues, but I can't tell anyone about it yet. But I will try to remember to contact you once it's announced.
Okay. That'll be great. Now, if we want to follow you on social media, you have a website. And it is genehaw.com. All one word. What about Super social media? Easy.
I am on Facebook a bit, but also Blue Sky and Instagram are the best ways to get me. I do have a Twitter, but I don't post art on it very much, and I don't post much of anything else on it. Okay. I mostly use it to follow experts on foreign policy and politics and a few other things like that. Okay. But I don't actually post there much.
Okay. Well, Gene, it's wonderful stuff. I got to make sure I get that hardcover because I've got to read more. I haven't read New May in a while. I've got to have some of that. And other good things,
too. I should mention, it's not a hardcover, though.
Oh, it's not? Oh, I thought it was.
No, it's going to be. It's a big, double-sized soft cover, nicely bound and stuff like
that. You're right. It's paperback. That's what it says in there. Yeah. I just assumed it was hardcover. Well, it's also, according to retail, it's $29.99. I bet that's a very reasonably priced book to read with all the good artwork and stuff in it. So I'm glad you pointed that out because I was laboring under the misapprehension that it was a hardcover. But is there any chance they might put it out in hardcover?
Maybe, but it kind of like the hardcovers are usually done as a way to do a double cash grab where they release the hardcover first, then they wait a few months, then they do the soft cover. Mm-hmm. So this is just a nicely bound soft cover. And if you want to get really fancy, you can, if you're, you know, a bookbinder, you can have a hardcover put on top of it. I know people who do this.
I have friends of mine who have taken old comic collections and had them put into a hardcover version. Mm-hmm. Somebody like a bookbinder will put a hardcover around it so that they have it as a hardcover edition. So
yeah, when people give me a comic a book like that to sign at a comic convention, I get very excited because it's like I just get to appreciate all the amazing bookbinding, handmade bookbinding artwork. Art crafting is a better word for crafting. It's just beautiful to see.
Well, Gene, I have to tell you, wonderful stuff that you're up to, and I just keep doing more, and I hope I get to talk with you sometime soon again, because you're always doing such great and creative stuff, and I just can't wait to, oh, man, we got to wait till April before this book comes out. I can't wait to read it. So, again, it's May, the Definitive Edition. Be sure to order it and go through your local store, go through your local library, go through all, whatever is convenient to make sure you get the book. That's the important thing. Get the book, because it's a great book. So, thanks for talking with me, Gene, and much success going forward. I hope you do just do more, even more terrific stuff.
Yeah, and thank you for a great interview. You have really thoughtful, thought-provoking questions.
Thank you.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
Tell me if this sounds familiar. You hacked League systems, disobeyed protocol, and endangered your lives. And your initiative resulted in the capture of 3 escaped felons, proving Warden Strange runs Bell Rev as a cover for criminal activity. Well done.